Hey friends, this is Daniel Emery Price from 40 Minutes in the Old Testament and 30 Minutes in the New Testament, and I wanted to invite you out to a Here We Still Stand regional event in Northwest Arkansas on April 22nd and 23rd. This is a two-day event that features tons of music and speakers and food and fellowship. I'll be there, joined by Scott Keith, Chad Bird, Dan Van Vores, Kelsey Kalimbara, Caleb Keith, Blake Flatley will be there, Andy Gullihorn and Jill Phillips will be performing a concert. It's going to be a lot of fun. You can go over to 1517.org/events, and you can find the Northwest Arkansas Regional Event. It's only $99 for this two-day event. We'd love to see you there. Get registered today.
Joined by my father, Dr. Sky Keith, and by Dr. Adam Francisco. The Thinking Fellows is part of the 1517 podcast network of shows. You can go to 1517.org/podcasts to see all of our episodes there. You can just go to the 1517 homepage to see all of the projects at 1517. The Thinking Fellows is one of the big ones, but it's not the only one. So you can go and see daily blogs. There are preaching helps for pastors every week if you use a lectionary. And there's also video. There's store, there's academies, we have a publishing house.
Conferences. One coming up in Northwest Arkansas
that you've heard ad fours on this show and other shows if you listen to more than one show on the network. So lots going on. Go to the homepage and see it up to date every day of the week.
Is there swag? Do you still sell swag?
Like t-shirts? We give swag away at conferences.
He's not up to date. I was not up to date. I went to the shop, and apparently we sell sweatshirts and hats and t-shirts, and I didn't know we sold any of that.
I knew we did.
So we can do that. So, all right, let's get into today's episode where we're moving forward. We're trying to be a little more positive than the last three episodes where we were just a bummer on the world. It's not our fault, though. It's because Lewis knew it was coming. And today we're going to do an episode on vocation. And I'm calling this episode, Do you have a higher calling? And I think a lot of American Christians I've met, definitely are asking themselves that question. And a lot of people who feel like they're in a rut, either at work or in life, are asking themselves that question a lot too. Is there something higher? Is there something that I should strive towards? Adam?
Well, I think it matters what you mean by higher. Are you talking about something better than what you're currently doing? Or is that just a way of saying, a common way of saying,
from God?
Do you have a calling from God? And if that's the way, what it is, of course, and you have multiple callings from God. Some of them look like they're just sort of biological. You know, you're a son or a daughter or a mom or dad or what have you. Some of them look like that you've made the choice. You know, your profession, for example, or where you maybe live, and so therefore your citizenship and so on. But we, you know, vocation, at least in our understanding of it or in the Lutheran understanding of it, not just Lutheran, but, you know, from the Reformation era, and I would say maybe just historic Christianity, though there's been bumps along the way and inventions along the way, like the invention of the calling into monasticism. Most Christians understand that God calls us to particular vocations that have certain, and I don't know if I like this term, but obligations associated with them.
Do you think that's true? That most Christians realize that?
I think so. It's not, in terms of how it's described or explained. Right. Yeah, I think so.
We've certainly gotten pushback for claiming that they don't in the past on episodes. Yeah.
That's probably me.
So,
I mean, I think when you get to, say, Luther and the Reformation, when vocation really comes into its own, when it's a kind of a focus in terms of figuring out the doctrine of vocation, it's much more made much more clear. At that time, I think it's assumed in centuries prior.
Right. You know. I'm on team vocation was probably the most important doctrine of the Lutheran Reformation. Now, before everyone freaks out, in this sense, that because justification obviously was the most important
yes.
article upon which the church stands or falls. But in this sense is that the life of the day-to-day Christian was affected for the positive, in many cases, the most by the Lutheran doctrine of vocation. Now, if you back that up, the Lutheran doctrine of vocation is not possible without the doctrine of justification.
Yeah.
You cannot teach somebody that they are free to serve Christ unbound by the threat of the law unless you have already taught them that on account of Christ alone, they've been justified and set free from sin, death, and the power of the devil. But as far as day-to-day life, the honoring of the mother, the father, the cook, the teacher, the bootmaker, whatever, that person now being told that their position and their station in life wasn't lowly slash less than the king.
But was actually divine.
The king, the prince, the priest. But in itself was actually divine, I think, on a just a day-to-day basis, impacted, that's a better way to say it, impacted the day-to-day life of the sort of person during the Reformation the most. Now, send angry emails.
And I'm on that team, too.
Okay.
Just yep. so you know.
So I think it's good to maybe do... and a word study, but like get into the grammar of this a little bit. Vocation is a calling. That's why I think higher calling is a good title for this. Comes from two, I think it'd be good to go with the two Latin words, the noun and the verb. Voco just means to call, and vocatio, which is a call or a summons. And I think the reason it's good to look at both is because you can... see that it requires two people. It requires, or two parties. It requires the person doing the calling and requires the person called upon. You can't have a call without another party being involved.
I think Caleb's current vocation is to flex on us with Latin.
Oh my gosh, that's so simple though.
See, that was a bigger flex even. No, yeah, I mean, that's absolutely it. But just sort of to say a little bit more on it, I think it's very important to point out that you can have a sense that you have these jobs as obligation. And apart from, you know, the knowledge that you are free on account of Christ alone, you will, even when you do these jobs as the non-Christian does, you will do them out of obligation. And sometimes that obligation is just even trying to be the best person that you can possibly be. That in itself, that trying to be the best person that you can possibly be, always comes with a threat, whether it's sort of explicit or implicit, that if you're not, there's going to be some, that best person you can possibly be, will be some consequence. The Christian, on the other hand, is no longer under that law, right? You don't strive to be a good student so that God will like you and love you more enough to say, enter into my kingdom, my servant, well done. That's not why you strive to be a good servant. He has already said that to you on account of Christ. Now, knowing that, you're free to be a good student, to be a good father, to be a good mother, without the threat that when you fail, there are going to be cosmic consequences for that, mm-hmm. right? Now, on this plane, when you fail as a father, there will certainly be sort of the lateral consequences with your family, with your children. But the consequence of that failure was already assumed into Christ. And when you do fail, and when you need reassurance, you can run to that cross one more time again. Remind, as Luther says, make the sign of the cross and remind yourself of your baptism, that you are a child of God on account of Christ alone, now encouraged to go back out and to try once more to be that good father, that good mother, that good student, that good teacher, or whatever. I mean, that's sort of, that's a, and one of the things that Uwe Simonetto always taught me about vocation is that we always say somebody is called into their vocation. And because it's a, like if you're calling me into the house, I come into the house, right? It's a thing. Like you said, there's two parts of it.
There's two parties, I think, is two parties, really,
yeah.
I think that's a part
even
that
two
we,
places.
We don't, we just don't care about today anymore is the parties involved, because it's all about us. It's all about personal happiness. It's all about self-fulfillment. Even if my job is enough, right, is often introspective. The thing is vocations are about dependencies, people who are dependent on you and the people you're dependent on. And so you issue calls out into the world to various people that you're hoping answer those calls, right? And various people in turn call you, and they're dependent on you. And this sort of is where even the difference between like your job is a vocation and you have vocations at your workplace, people who are dependent on you, starts to come into play as well, right? There, you know, when you're hired at a workplace, we would call that a vocation, but there's particular people, maybe the individual who hired you, the manager, the owner, the person who is calling you to do something, and they're dependent on your job being done. And the same thing at your family, children are calling on you, and they're dependent on your job being done. And without that dependency, when it's just optional, sort of the necessity of vocation goes down. And one of the reasons vocation is so prevalent in the Reformation is because of people who were opting out of those dependencies, those right. relationships. Right. And that's what Adam right. is talking about with the monastic system here, is that was a group of people who tried to isolate themselves from the intricate dependencies of civilization, whether that be at the family level, at the workplace level, at the civil level. It was getting rid of those attachments, those dependencies. And I think there are many ways in which we, obviously our society isn't monastic, but in where more and more people are trying to lower the amount of dependence they have and the amount of dependency they have on other people as well. Right? How much of a virtue is it in our society to become self-made, right? Mm. You know, these types of things, to say I wasn't dependent on anybody for my success.
I think, I mean, I don't know where you wanted to go with this, but I think even sort of the data that you see regarding people getting married much later, right. people having children much later, people having much fewer children. I'm not so sure it's as big a thing as it was maybe 5 years ago, but the whole big gig economy thing was big several years ago.
I don't want to work for anybody else.
I don't want to work for anybody else. I don't want to have to answer to anybody.
Gig economy is still is huge.
I certainly.
What does that mean?
It means that it's sort of like freelancer. You work gig to gig.
Gotcha.
Something like Uber, you know, food delivery services, all these are considered gig economy because you're employed on a daily basis.
Part of the corporate structure, man.
You're employed generically by Uber, but it's not that you come in 9 to 5. You determine your hours. It's about the demand and then contracting you to meet that demand. Each time is a new contract. Every time somebody clicks your car on Uber, that's a new contract. And you could turn off your rides and just stop making money. And so it's kind of on, you know, you're still a solo act. They're just the infrastructure that gives you access to the various contracts, right? Mm. And so it's basically contractual work that you can start or stop at any point. And so you don't have to go into the, you know, if you didn't like work today, you don't have to go get those contracts tomorrow. You can go do something.
To be fair to these people, I think that there are some socioeconomic sort of structures and strictures which have sort of led to this. I think when people are asked, why are they waiting longer to get married? Why are they waiting longer to have children? Why are they having fewer children? A lot of it has to do with the feeling that they can't afford the things that they had as they were provided to them. And so Maybe if they delay, they'll be able to afford them someday. Maybe if they have fewer kids, they'll be able to provide those things for fewer kids, even if their parents were able to provide them for more. There's all of this there, but I do think there is a fear to get involved with, you might call it day-to-day dependencies.
And there's an underlying myth that relates to our last episode, which is the quality of your life will be better the less dependencies there are in it.
Yeah.
The fewer children you have, the higher quality of life you will have and they will have.
But you to know, tie it into the last episode, if you're concerned, if you think the world's going to crap and you don't think you can do anything about it and you're concerned with the fact that you don't seem to be able to do anything about it, the thing that you actually could do would be more personally involved with the people that God has or slash wants to put into your life, and wife, or just say spouse, children, parents, and serve them vocationally, as Luther says, as a little Christ in the home to them. And you can have these conversations. You can talk to somebody. You can help form somebody's view of themselves in the world. You can forgive somebody in the name of Jesus. You can all of these things that you just cannot do on a global scale.
Yeah, I think it's part of it is knowing that the problems is that you will be needed and that you also will need other people. You are not going to be an island and make it as an island. It's not going to be fulfilling. You're not going to be able to change anything. Your impact on the world will be minimal.
Well, the thing is, did you want to say something, Adam?
Oh no, something popped in my head. I think it was Chesterton who said everybody wants to change the world, but they can't even be bothered to do the dishes for mom.
Right.
I don't know. That just popped.
Or
in my
on
head.
The sort of the since I got some emails about how mean I was to Jordan Peterson, right?
Oh, did you?
Yeah,
he did.
On the pro Jordan Peterson side, I mean, one might be able to say everybody wants to change the world, but they can't even wake up in the morning and serve the vocation of roommate by cleaning their room and making their bed, right? You can say the same thing. One of the things I think is interesting about the way we teach vocation, and apparently all Christians do, that I wasn't unaware of, is this. Most of what we do in vocation, we will never even realize we did, right? Some of it you will, for sure. I mean, there'll be times, like if you're a father, where your kids come up to you and hug you and say, I love you, or you got mad at them, and they'll come and say, I'm sorry, and you can say, I forgive you, and that'll be, like, plainly acute to you. You will understand what has just gone on. But most of it is going to be like the parable of the sheep and the goats, right? Where when the king at the last day turns to you and says, well done, good and faithful servant. You fed me when I was hungry. You gave me water when I was thirsty. When I needed clothes, you gave them to me. When I was sick and in prison, you came and saw me. And you'll literally say, truly I say to you, I never knew you when you were hungry or thirsty or these things. Because you just won't remember having done them, right? Because it's just, when the blessing part of this is that it's, on the whole, it's just life. With the caveat, though, that you have to be at the point where you believe it is your vocation to live life.
Yeah.
And not to hide from it.
Yeah, you know, I know it's a little controversial, I guess, but Luther called it the nut of his theology, the two kinds of righteousness. I mean, you were talking about it, though you didn't use the phrase earlier, Scott, that we have this sort of, we live life in a sort of cruciform way, in the shape of a cross, right? We have this vertical relationship with God, and that relationship is taken care of, tetelestai. It's finished, you know. We passively receive the righteousness of Christ through his death on the cross and our baptism when we hear the words of forgiveness and so on. But there's another aspect of life where we actually actively pursue righteousness. We try to do better, not because it's going to earn God's favor, not because it's going to make us feel like we're living our best life now or whatever, but we try to do what is right in all of our vocations, try to get better and so on for the sake of our neighbor.
Right.
And that's it.
That's it.
There's nothing grandiose about it, and oftentimes you'll feel like everything's going completely unnoticed. But in the end, it does matter to your neighbor. If you're, let's say you cut your lawn every week. Well, you guys probably don't have grass up there in the mountain, but let's say you.
It's snowing, so I've got to go out and shovel again.
That's a good point.
You keep your stuff squared away.
Yeah.
Makes life probably a little better than having a hoopty sitting in the yard and trash floating around.
Adam, what's a hoopty? Neighbor.
What's a hoopty?
I don't know. It's a car, I think, a trash car. Okay.
You got us both on that
one. I don't
think
I've ever used that word before. I have no idea how it popped into my head.
It's actually dumping snow now. So,
and it wasn't supposed to.
Yeah. Having my snowblower in order and ready to go is going to be very useful for after this podcast.
Yeah. I mean, I just think these little things where we're trying to do what is right, though we fail all the time, makes all the difference in small ways and sometimes large ways to our near neighbors, the people within your own household, and maybe even the people living next door. And that's the Christian life.
Yeah. I just did it at the Naloma conference that you gave me the lead to go speak at, because it was on evangelism and apologetics. I brought this up because, and I'll say it all the time, is that when you participate in sort of an actual evangelistic effort with an individual, and that becomes an apologetic effort. And over the course of time, sometimes days, weeks, months, years, whatever, that person finally comes to the faith. There's two things you realize is that one, when a sinner actually comes to the faith, and this, I'm not this emotional. You can honestly almost hear the angels sing when this happens. The second thing that happens is that they almost always ask the same question in just a matter of time. And I'm going to put it a little coarsely, but it kind of goes a little bit like this. Wow, that's great that Jesus died for my sins and I didn't have to do anything for him to save me. Now, what can I do for God because he saved me? And the answer that God gives to that question, just like in the parable of the sheep and the goats, is almost like, well, nothing. You can't do anything for me. I'm the God of the universe. I created all things with a word. I saved all people with my death and resurrection. When I declare them righteous, they are righteous. And all these things, and I don't need your help. And then just at the moment of disappointment for the new Christian, you can kind of break in and say, but he has put people in your life. He has called people into your life who need you. They need you to be a friend. They need you to be a faithful coworker. They need you to be a father, a mother. You need to be their child, you know, whatever. You can take this on and on. And they do need you. And whenever you serve them faithfully, you're serving God. Whenever you do this for the least of these, my brethren, you've done it for me. And that's how you serve. That's how you answer that question of gratefulness, of I'm so grateful that God saved me, a poor, miserable sinner, on account of Christ through none of my own works. Now, what can I do for God? You answer that question by simply serving your neighbor. But we have to see this in terms of your neighbor, like your actual person, like the person that you can probably name, right? Now, sometimes this will be people that you don't know and that you meet and that you maybe donate to, but more often it's just the people in your normal everyday lives whose names you know and who you probably love more than you love anybody else on this planet. Sometimes call those people family.
Yeah, I think it's this is one of the reasons it's often difficult to talk about it, because it is, the vocations are somewhat different for each person you meet. I mean, there are some, you know, the amount of dependency ranges so dramatically that this is where, like we were saying last time, what can I do in response to the changing world, the negative changing, where you will have the most impact, and where you actually, you know, like with your family, if you have a wife and children, or if you have a husband and children, or whichever way that goes, you, not only provide things like food and a home and a sense of safety and security to those people. But also, you are going to be the first touch point of moral guidance in the world, decision making, teaching them how to reason, teaching them how to deal with other human beings, and being careful about exporting that or letting somebody else teach them something that you think is wrong, and why you think that's wrong to them, not just that it is. That's the other thing you see, right? Is that you might give children boundaries, but never help them understand why those boundaries are there. And then when somebody else offers a different or maybe even appealing set of boundaries, you know, them trying to choose or trying to get out of your family.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Part of this is going to be to respect other people enough to treat them like people. When you treat other people, even your children, like people, you just don't hand down words from on high. They come with explanations and reasons. I mean, sometimes for the sake of immediacy, it's
you need to declare something. Yeah,
you just need things need to stop, right? Or go. But eventually, as children get older and the conversations get deeper, you explain why certain behaviors are important to you, and it usually has to do with because if those behaviors don't exist, it impacts negatively upon the other people that they are called to. Mm-hmm. Their brothers and sisters, their mother, and so on.
Yeah. I mean,
Adam's got lots of kids. He knows that, right, Adam?
Yeah. I'm a little tired from those lots of kids. I've been thinking about this a lot lately with, you know, I don't know if we talked about this on the air, but it's fostering two kids. Those aren't my children. And in a way, it's sort of like we put ourselves in that particular vocation with them. And I struggle a bit with, you know, do I raise these as my own, or am I just sort of temporarily helping out? Is it like a real vocation? What is this? I know that temporarily it matters a great deal, but you know, I get a little, you know, I'm like you, Scott, pessimistic. So
I'm a realist. Like, buddy.
What's the point in all this? You know, it'll all be undone someday.
I think that the situation that you and Rachel are in, and that the foster children themselves are in, is a tragic. Well, let me say it two ways. The fact that they're in this foster care is a tragic example of what goes wrong when vocation is not taken seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The fact that you're trying to help them is an example of trying to sort of expand out your concentric circles of vocation one step to help people that you're, you know, not biologically obligated to, but have decided to obligate yourselves to. In that terms. And that's the best way to do it because you've decided you've done that freely. You could step out of it freely. You could, you know, you could do it again freely. There's one thing to be obligated under the sense of the law, right? Which we all are to an extent with our born biological children. But you just have to, yeah, make sure they're fed and stuff like that. That doesn't go too deep. But there's another sense to do what you've done, which is to decide to obligate yourself freely, right? But that's a free decision. I'm pretty sure you didn't do it so that you could earn favor with God. I'm pretty sure you did it because there's a need in your community to help these children, and there's probably more of them in certain communities than others.
Yeah, yep. Or maybe my wife just coaxed me into it.
Yeah, well,
I mean,
it could be that.
I wouldn't see it as bleakly as like giving yourself a vocation, Adam. You put yourself in a situation where another group of human beings can call on you for help, right? And they did, and you guys answered that call. Yeah,
this is the thing. The funny thing with the more your vocations multiply, I think. It's not like time management, but you know, there is a point where probably adding to your vocations is not always mm-hmm. helpful if it's going to take a toll on your health or something like that. You know, and there's a fine line there, right?
Yeah. You can't save the whole world, right?
Exactly.
Like through your voc, and that's I think, yeah, where some of the immediate ones go is, what's the extent of the amount of people or the amount of places I can be available to at one time? Probably smaller than you think, before harm starts coming to the first ones you had, right? Like, before harm starts coming to the call to your spouse or the call to your children or work or whatever those are. And that's where some of the decision-making comes, is you then have to prioritize the various calls that you have. And I think that's where the specific comes, is that you can't, you know, if you watch the news and you see people suffering 10,000 miles away, those people are maybe calling out for help, or if somebody two states over is suffering and calling out for help, can you answer those? Are you the best person to answer them, even because if the appeal is big to you? I think it's the way to calculate that would probably be to weigh it against your other callings in life, right? Like, does it require you to quit your job? Does quitting your job put your children in a place where they potentially don't have a home or food anymore? Does, you know, that, do those levels of risk then begin to harm other people for the sake of helping somebody far away?
I think that, we ended that last episode and it was kind of bleak, right? How does this help that? How does what we're talking about regarding vocation, because the bleak part of the finishing up the abolition of man was that Lewis was kind of prescient in his prophecies of doom, right? But we gave some examples of, you know, you can't, when this has become a big world problem, right, affecting the whole world, it seems you can just get mad at everything. I'm just mad at everything. I'm mad at everything all the time. And even worse so in our day and age, because we see everything all the time. But how does this idea help with that? How does that make that more, take it from a negative episode to a positive episode?
The prophecies of doom are, I think, we have to go past that, like, it's just bad for society, and be able to say that particular people are going to suffer because of those changes. And that those particular people are going to be, you know, I think two episodes ago when you talked about, like, the Me Too, and you brought up specifically, I have a wife and a daughter, and I wouldn't want that happening. You realize that the sexual depravity in that case actually causes people to suffer. It causes a lot of people to suffer, but in particular, it may be causing the people who have a already issued call out to you, are dependent on you, to suffer. And so what can you do about sexual depraved culture? Is that you can help the people in your life who are dependent on you, who are calling on you, not to suffer under those circumstances.
Well, you could first and foremost not be the person that's
causing the suffering.
You could teach the people in your life to sort of be on a lookout
for that,
and to sort of avoid, deflect, report type thing, you know, when necessary. There's all sorts of things you can do, but you can only, again, I'm gonna say, you can only do that if you're actually in a real relationship with another person. Mm-hmm. You've been willing to make yourself dependent and to have other people dependent on you. That's exceptionally important. If you remember in that episode, I brought up the sort of guy at the school board, when the lady, he's at a parent at a school board meeting, and one of the school board superintendents says, you know, it's all of our responsibility to take care of your children. We all love your children just as much as you do. And his answer to that was, no, you don't. Her response was, yes, we do. And he says, okay, if that's true, tell me their names.
So,
and you can't, right? And that's the thing, is that when the tendency, and this is something that Lewis brought up in Abolition of Man that we didn't even get at, which is sort of the statism that will come from abstracting everything out and scientisming everything out so that only experts can do make the decisions through X, Y, or Z. Everything gets pushed out, even in with your own family, gets pushed off of you onto sort of some weird oligarchy that decides right and wrong for people that you were called to serve. And that's just not how it works. You know, In the 90s, there was this It Takes a Village, Hillary Rodham Clinton's book about raising children. And it was, I remember reading it in the 90s. I have not read it since, so I could be getting it all wrong. But my recollection of it is that it was Marxist in the sense that Adam described Marxism in the last episode, where everything is abstracted upward until you get to sort of the hegemony of the proletariat, right, Adam?
And dictatorship of the proletariat. That's right.
Right, and then that is unite. That's what's responsible for everything. That is anti-Christian in this sense. It obfuscates your actual
duty to raise
calling
children.
In your vocation of father and mother. Even in your vocation of child, for Pete's sake, or aunt and uncle, or grandfather and grandmother, and on and on and on. I mean, this has become almost as much a family episode as a vocation episode. That's to be expected, because the people that God has placed in your life to serve are the ones that are closest to you, going outward from there.
Well, often we're sold that our most important vocation is actually our political vocation, because it's the state's job to care more about the well-being of children and about people than it is yours. And the best way you could even treat your children is by enabling the state to do the best job possible at every level, right? And so then your number one vocation becomes your political activity in the world. And I think we are seeing the effects of that today. I think people maybe don't claim this, but you can see that the number one thing people talk about is politics, political happenings, what they can do, how upset they are about it. And the reason why is because the best thing you can do to change the world is enable a politician, a bureaucrat, or a system somewhere else to affect change for everybody, not just for your kids, not just for your community, but for everybody. Change isn't good if it's just individual. And
if you want to know how ridiculous that is, even just on a human level, try to tell even your best friend that he's raising his children wrong and see the reaction. Let alone somebody that you don't know, don't like, whose name you don't know.
Right.
Right? See how long you have that friend as a best friend or otherwise once you tell them that they've messed up their kids.
Yeah. I mean, and again,
I wasn't talking about you, Adam.
The whole I think, again, the whole reason to do this is because, you know, if we acknowledge that the abolition of man, the abolition of truth, the abolition of morality, all of this is causing people to suffer, is that you can help people in your life suffer less, or deal with it, or know how to act in the midst of it, and all sorts of things. And it's hard to be extremely universal with that outside of that God has given us some objective guidance on this. And, we don't need to beat around the bush about that, like, you know, Luther in the Heidelberg disputation, the law of God is most beneficial doctrine for this life. If you're looking for guidance on how to treat the people in your life, I would start with the Decalogue.
For this life.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, that's not a bad place to start. If you're, if this is an example from your life. If your child is suffering in school because of the way schools naturally have to deal with the fact that they have 20, 25 kids to one teacher in a classroom, and your kid is getting, you know, the ass end of that system.
And you've tried public school or private school, then public school, then private school again.
You know, you then pulled out that kid.
Yeah.
You know, my brother got taken out of school because he just endlessly was harmed by other children at those schools, at every single school he went to. And there was never an instance where the authority at the schools, regardless of curriculum, were ever able to help him because of the way that system worked.
He just wasn't well suited.
So what did that mean? That meant that
the natural classroom situation.
What did that mean? That means you were called in that particular circumstance to take your kid out of school. Like that, you know, is everybody always universally called to the same things? No. But there was a particular person suffering under the system that was established for education.
And I'm not saying it was, but even if a certain amount of that suffering was his own fault.
Right. You were able to do something that intervened to help mitigate that suffering.
And he turned out all right.
Right. to say that what you really should have done was gone to the school board and had a bunch of meetings and appeals about why school systems don't help kids who struggle to socially get along with other kids would have left your kid in the school suffering at the same time.
Well, I would assume that even if I were very convincing and they decided to change things, that that change would take more time than were, you know, would be beneficial for Joshua.
If you could even identify a change that would be beneficial for kids who weren't Joshua.
I said it was an assumption. I didn't say it was a realistic
assumption. That's what I'm saying is why that doesn't actually help with your vocation. Because assuming what's good for your kid or what will help your kid is going to help everybody is just madness. And that's sort of where we're at.
I do think, and I think we've heard of them lately, so I don't want to get parents who try to change things at the school board level because it has worked recently in some places. Mm-hmm. And it's worked kind of dramatically recently in some places. So I don't want to always just knock on that. And maybe that is how they're fulfilling their vocation.
And maybe that's the right course to do in certain circumstances.
Yeah, but that's the thing is that you have to freely make those decisions.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Hey, why don't you describe to us what we are going to do in the next probably? Well, we got to finish up. Are we going to finish up?
I don't know.
We don't have to.
Don't say it. Yeah.
Okay. But you had a good idea for a series of episodes.
Yes. Yeah, so I kind of want to do. I think this could be a very long series, but a series called Why You Should, and we'll just identify various things you should do. So maybe it'll be like...
Why you should do jiu-jitsu, Adam.
Yeah, why you should, you know, study philosophy. Why you should, why you should read Martin Luther. Why you should read C.S. Lewis.
Why you should train a hunting dog.
Why you should train a hunting dog. Why you know...
Yeah, why you should prefer vodka over gin, something like that. Right?
Oh, that would actually be kind of a fun episode.
Yeah,
Caleb can go for hours on things like coffee and bourbon and things like that. But just hours.
But I think we could cover. The reason I want to do this is we have a lot of. I know we denounced expertism, but we have a lot of experts in our fellowship on particular subjects and matters, and then outside of the fellowship of people we know and could highlight.
Hold on a second. We did not denounce the idea of an expert.
Right.
We denounce expertism, which is the deferring to experts on every issue as though the oligarchy of experts can make better decisions than a well-informed individual.
Right. Why you should, the use of the term should, this is rhetorical, right? We're not prescribing that.
Why, vodka. Why would it's going to ask the question, why would you do X, Y, Z, right?
No, I like that.
This is search engine optimization here. Just stop.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people we know who will be great to have on these subjects. Like, I want to have Steve Paulson on the Thank You Fellows to tell people why they should read Luther. I want to have C.J. Armstrong on to tell people why they should study the classics. I want to have various people we know we've met or are in our fellowship who can make a case for the particular study or pursuit of a thing and do that on the Thank You Fellows and give people that basic overview of what that is and why it's worth pursuing.
Great.
So I think that'd be a lot of fun for 2022. And I think the other great part about this is that we can fit almost anything into it, subject-wise, especially across the mission of 1517 when it comes to the various things that help support our mission to declare and defend. You know, we can do why you should do apologetics, why you should know, you know, why you should care about the history of the resurrection, why you should all sorts of different things. There's such a broad way to do this, and it'll cover topics we've done before, but I think with the particular spin on why would a person benefit from knowing this can really add a new flavor to things we've covered in the past.
Sounds good to me. Sounds fun.
Word. All right, guys. Well, thank you for listening to the Thinking Fellows podcast. Hopefully, we might be able to get I think we're going to be able to get a jump start on this by the next episode of this show. And we'll continue with that with 2022. I'm still taking Q&A. We will break up episodes, especially if we do a very long series with Q&A and things like that. And hopefully 2022 can be a return to having lots of guests on the Thinking Fellows and all sorts of things. So thank you for listening. We will catch you next time. Bye.